Coming up, restoring a buffalo herd, central to the spiritual life of Blackfeet Indians, Lucky Severson reports. Also, Fred DeSam Lazaro has the story of a former hippie, now a prominent doctor, internationally admired. And a Christmas story from Bethlehem, where doctors and nurses of all religions at the Holy Family Hospital take care of the needy, especially newborns and their mothers.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. President Obama this week gave his final major speech on national security. Speaking at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida, he said the United States must not stigmatize Muslims in the fight against terror. He said if the U.S. acts as if it is at war with Islam, the nation will, quote, lose sight of the very principles we claim to defend. Meanwhile, more than 300 American Muslim leaders have sent an open letter to President-elect Donald Trump, urging him to reconsider and reject some of the people he's selected as advisors and cabinet officials. The letter expresses concern about anti-Muslim statements that have been made by several individuals, but it does not mention any specific names. The United Nations has issued its annual appeal for humanitarian funds for the coming year, and it's a record request, $22.2 billion. That's a 400% increase from the amount requested 10 years ago. Humanitarian officials say it's needed because of the many protracted crises in places such as Syria, Iraq, and South Sudan. As the Vatican gets ready for Christmas, Pope Francis is urging Christians to hold on to hope, even amid darkness. This week, he again raised eyebrows, this time with some comments he made in an interview with a Belgian Catholic publication. Francis strongly criticized media outlets that spread scandal, disinformation, and fake news. He likened the focus on those things to an unnatural fixation. Also this week, the Vatican released a new document that reiterates the Church's long-held position that gay men should not become priests. It says the Church can't overlook what it calls the negative consequences that can derive from the ordination of persons with deep-seated homosexual tendencies. LGBT advocates expressed disappointment, saying they'd hoped that under Francis, the Church would be more open. A wide array of religious leaders celebrated the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' decision not to allow the Dakota Access Pipeline to be constructed near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. Native Americans have been protesting for months, saying the land is sacred and the pipeline would harm their water supply. Many religious groups stood in solidarity with the protesters. After the decision, prayer services of Thanksgiving were held across the country. But activists said they are not letting up on their efforts. They're concerned about what might happen under the Trump administration.
Standing Rock isn't the only place that has this kind of a fight going on. And so we continue to stand up and advocate and fight for those whose voice might not be heard.
Last month, after another dispute, the federal government canceled controversial drilling leases on land in Montana that's considered sacred by the Blackfeet Native American tribe. We have a story today from that area by Lucky Severson about buffaloes and their almost total destruction long ago. Now, the U.S. and Canada are creating a kind of restoration not only of the animals, but also for the Blackfeet Indians, for whom the buffaloes and all life are sacred.
Hey. To say this was a big day for the Blackfeet Indians would not be saying enough.
They were everything to us. They were our existence, you know, and we just, they kept us alive.
And now they're back on the Montana Reservation. 87 bison, or buffalo, as the Blackfeet prefer to call them, genetically pure descendants of the ones shipped away when the tribe was on its knees. Keith Anne runs the Wildlife Conservation Society's bison program that helped return the animals.
That this animal was central to all of their being. And so their stories, the myths, the beliefs they have are all wrapped around this business of their relationship to Ini, or Iniwa, as the Blackfeet call them.
When the buffalo were returned home to the Blackfoot Nation here in northern Montana after more than 140 years, it was seen by Blackfoot leaders as a very significant event, a new beginning, a renaissance, a way to restore a culture that was practically decimated, physically and spiritually, by the near extinction of the buffalo.
Today, the Blackfeet Nation consists of three smaller tribes in Canada and the larger one here in the U.S. The little town of Browning, Montana, near Glacier National Park, is the center of the reservation where the buffalo were returned. The chairman of the Tribal Business Council is Harry Barnes.
When we lost the buffalo in the 1870s, it caused a dramatic change in our society, a monumental shift in everything. The buffalo was always part of our daily life. It was in front of us. It was behind us. It was around us. It created our shelter, our clothing. And so that was an integral part of us. And then after we lost it, then we had to, is a major shift in our spirituality.
They prayed to him. The buffalo talked to them.
Earl Old Person is the longest running chief in the U.S. He was actually named Old Person as a baby, said to be about 87 years old. Chief Old Person has lived the culture, the traditions, the songs.
And that song goes like this. When our old people that's left, when they hear these songs, it makes them cry, because that was their way of life.
Irvin Carlson is president of the Intertribal Buffalo Council.
And they're just a part of our being and our spirituality. I mean, not only the buffalo, but all of the animals are very spiritually connected to Indian people.
Everything what we pray to is what Creator made. That's a grasshopper, that's a beetle, that's an ant. They all have a spirit. They all have a life.
The rock has a life.
Right, rock has a life, yeah.
Blackfeet, like Sheldon Carlson, embrace a religious system that grew out of 10,000 years of experience with nature. The beaver bundle is an example, a bundle of treasured remnants from their natural environment, like an antelope skin that's passed down through the generations.
With you, religion is here, there, everywhere, all the time.
Mm-hmm. We pray pretty much every day. I get up in the morning and light my smudge and pray over the beaver bundle.
Sheldon Carlson spends just about every day with the buffalo, with the old herd and the new one. The difference is extremely important to the Blackfeet. The old herd of about 400, which the tribe has owned for several decades, is considered tainted because it had been in physical contact with cattle and elk. The new herd is considered pure because these buffalo have been kept on a remote preserve for more than a century by the Canadian government. A historic treaty signed by several tribes in 2014 paved the way to return some of the herd to their original owners, the Blackfeet, long renowned as hunters and gatherers. But they were not prepared for the white man, who brought with him disease like smallpox that killed two-thirds of the tribe in the 1830s. The white men were much more sophisticated and duplicitous in drawing up treaties that were broken one after another, squeezing the tribe into smaller and smaller spaces. At one point in the 1850s and 60s, there were an estimated 30 to 40 million buffalo roaming the Great Plains and the Intermountain West. The Blackfeet considered themselves prosperous.
So as long as we had the land and the buffalo and the rest of the animals, we survived, we prospered, we were self-reliant, self-governing, you know, everything good we had.
But the white man had repeating rifles and were able to slaughter the buffalo on an industrial scale. The U.S. Army played a role, too. General William Tecumseh Sherman ordered troops to shoot the buffalo until they became too scarce to support the Redskins. Those were his words. By 1889, the millions of buffalo had been reduced to hundreds. 99% of the herds had been slaughtered.
The more I study this and the more I understand our history, locally and regionally, there were some major atrocities that happened when these two cultures clashed. And part of those atrocities is things like the destruction of bison, which was intentional, which was purposeful, which was aimed at helping to subjugate Native people.
John Murray is a tribal historic preservation officer. He says the loss of the buffalo affected the way the Blackfeet saw themselves.
In our situation, it was an outright attempt to eradicate our culture. And I think it was so effective, the model of colonization with Blackfeet people, most Lotte Indians, that we've internalized that.
There's a human pride in being able to care for yourself and your loved ones. We've lost that.
And that's where the new herd of buffalo comes in. The hope here among the elders is that they will help restore pride, self-worth, and dreams among the young.
My goal is not just having 1,000. I'd like to see about 10,000. That's what I'd like to see. And I'd like to see them just roaming free.
Thanks to a very recent decision by the Obama administration, Blackfeet land that had been set aside for oil and gas leases has now been returned fully to the tribe, land that would allow lots of buffalo to roam free.
When I was a younger person, I started growing, letting my hair grow. People would say, well, we thought you were a better man than that. You know, cut your hair, the buffalo are never coming back. You know, but they did, they came back. And they're here. And we're complete again.
It's increasingly unlikely that John Murray will ever cut his hair short. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson on the Blackfoot Indian Reservation.
Our correspondent Fred DeSam Lazaro has a story now about a former hippie who's a doctor and an international hero for his work helping to wipe out smallpox.
The shiny red T-Bird convertible is a nod to its owner's Detroit roots, but it's in San Francisco that he first made a name for himself. He had quite a name to begin with.
It's so arrogant to have a name like Brilliant that I put sometimes Brilliant and sometimes not so, and that's what I sign.
The memoir Larry Brilliant is autographing chronicles a life of unusual paths, a civil rights and anti-Vietnam War activist and hippie who helped eradicate smallpox from the world. Today, he's an advisor to Silicon Valley philanthropists who are helping him tackle other major diseases.
In the last 30 years, we've had 30 pathogens, viruses, jump from animals to humans. We know some of them: SARS, MERS, swine flu, bird flu, Ebola, Zika.
It all began in 1969 in San Francisco, where Brilliant had come for an internship after medical school and volunteered for an unusual assignment at the recently closed federal prison on Alcatraz. The island had been taken over by a group of about 100 Native Americans, one of whom was about to have a baby.
She wanted to give birth on Indian liberated land.
He delivered the baby and returned from the island a month later, covered in the blood from a patient he was evacuating to a San Francisco hospital. That got him on the evening news.
That night, somebody from Warner Brothers saw me on television, and they called me the next day and they said, we're starting a movie in 2 or 3 days. We're going to be gathering at the same place I got off the boat. And it's going to be a movie about hippies and rock and roll. It's going to have the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane and Pink Floyd. And we have one doctor, but we think we ought to have two doctors who are rock doctors who can manage the tent for anybody who gets hurt and also can play an extra.
The movie, a sequel to the highly successful Woodstock film, was a box office flop, but Brilliant forged friendships with some of the era's iconic figures.
What we have in mind is breakfast in bed for $400,000.
They included the Woodstock MC, who became famous in clown costume as Wavy Gravy.
I am so honored to meet you.
Mr. Honored, please.
I'm Tom.
At 80, he slowed only physically. The friends still gather often and recount their adventures, including a journey across Europe toward India. They had planned to feed flood victims in what was then East Pakistan, now Bangladesh.
And the idea was that we had so much media from doing the free kitchen at Woodstock that if we got there and started feeding people, that they would embarrass the government. My God, there's hippies doing it. We better do it better. And that was the plan. But then the Indo-Pakistani war broke out and we hung a left to Kathmandu.
For Larry Brilliant and his wife Girija, this was a transformative journey. They became disciples of a spiritual leader or guru, Neem Karoli Baba.
Were you able to converse with him in Hindi?
Yeah.
They studied meditation and Hindi, a big asset for the assignment he would soon receive from the guru to help eradicate smallpox in India and Bangladesh, which were among the last holdouts for the virus that had killed 500 million people through history.
During the Summer of Love, when I was cavorting with my friends, 2.5-3 million people died around the world from smallpox. Bad disease, most people thought it could never be eradicated. We had had a vaccine for 200 years. And what we were doing is we were vaccinating everybody.
That strategy worked in the West and developed countries, but could never work in India, he says, with a population then of 600 million people, some 20 million of whom were on a bus or train on any given day. The hippie doctor coaxed his way into the World Health Organization team that took a different approach, tracking down every single infected person and vaccinating everyone around them, creating a so-called ring of immunity so the virus couldn't spread. It was a Herculean task.
We had to visit every house in India every month for 20 months. We made 2 billion house calls, 150,000 people, doctors from 170 countries, every religion, every race, every language, every geographic area, all working together.
Smallpox became the first disease ever eradicated from the planet. Brilliant went on to become a leading expert on infectious disease, a consultant to the White House most recently when Ebola threatened to escalate.
What is it going to take to prevent an outbreak?
Today, Larry Brilliant heads a group called the SCOLD Global Threats Fund, which is focused on issues like climate change, nuclear proliferation, and pandemics. It is an affiliate of the SCOLD Foundation, which is also a funder of some PBS programs.
It's about detect and report.
These epidemiologists are setting up pilot studies to gather data in 28 countries, trying to determine early patterns of how a disease breaks out.
Wouldn't you like to create advisory panels and partnerships with tech companies, major universities, epid departments?
Brilliant has raised millions of philanthropic dollars for other efforts that include the SAVA Foundation, an eye care charity now in several countries that he started with Wavy Gravy.
It's probably one of the coolest things that anybody could do is to reach around the world and help somebody that's blind not to be blind anymore. And we've done that 3.5 million times.
After the smallpox campaign, Larry Brilliant began forging ties in Silicon Valley, where he's been a kind of guru to many tech industry leaders, including the late Apple founder Steve Jobs. The two men met in the 70s here in India, where both had come seeking spiritual harbor.
And certainly have not been boring.
And that Himalayan ashram experience remains a guiding influence today for Brilliant and his wife Girija, who retains the Hindu name given to her by their guru.
We have Shiva and Krishna to welcome you.
The Brilliant home is replete with symbols that reflect a wide embrace of all religions.
There's so much to learn about ethical behavior in the Bhagavad Gita, the Talmud, all of the Old Testament, the New Testament. I love Mark. I mean, it's hard for my Jewish friends to understand, because I'm Jewish, why do I feel so close and like Jesus so much? It's, I mean, to me, clearly, the greatest man that ever existed. And in Islam, there's so many wonderful things in Islam.
It's a perspective forged in the spirit of the 60s, a decade of social upheaval, but one that he says was filled with hope for harmony.
When I was with Neem Karoli Baba, he would always say, sub ek. It
all
means
one.
They're all one.
From the deck of his home, I asked him to read a passage from his book that summarized the era.
It was neither all Martin Luther King nor all Charles Manson. We came of age sexually in the golden era between the advent of birth control pills and the epidemic of HIV/AIDS. Spiritually, it was like a greenhouse in which the most beautiful flowers blossomed alongside the most vicious weeds. Progress demands that humans try to create better conditions for everyone, and change requires risk. What I have learned is just this: leave room for God, leave room for love, and never, ever lose your sense of humor.
The book is called Sometimes Brilliant. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in Mill Valley, California.
Now, a Christmas story about Bethlehem. It's not about the city and the Bible's account of Jesus' birth or the tensions of many years. Our story takes place on a hillside 500 yards from the Church of the Nativity. Here and elsewhere, members of the Catholic Order of Malta have embraced as their mission taking care of the poor and sick, especially of mothers and their babies, especially preemies and others who need special care.
But the aim is to help people, to help the poor, to help the sick, Muslim, Christian, or whatever. And we try to help also the poor people who doesn't have access to medical help. So usually don't refuse anybody.
The majority of patients here are Muslim, while the majority of doctors and nurses are Christian. Over the last 25 years, they say, they've delivered more than 68,000 babies. Holy Family Hospital survives through the generosity of its friends nearby and in the West. Its staff is proud of its state-of-the-art equipment and teaching, and so are its patients.
They are happy that they have a hospital like this hospital. It's one of the best hospitals in this area, and all of the people know that.
25% of those served by the hospital reside in refugee camps run by the United Nations.
It is important here what we do is giving help, medical care, to the people of these regions, in this desert, Judean desert.
Nearby Bedouins, for instance. They can't get to the hospital, so the hospital staff sends care to them.
We need to continue serving the poor people, exactly the same way, because our philosophy here in the hospital that the poor deserve the best.
At several locations here and all over the world, the Order of Malta has been caring for the poor and sick for more than 900 years. Our thanks to our colleague Bill Baker and his brother Larry for telling us about the work of the Holy Family Hospital. Finally, on our calendar for Catholics, December 12th is the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. It commemorates Mary's appearance to Juan Diego, an indigenous Mexican, in 1531 through an apparition on his cloak. This year, the U.S. Catholic bishops are urging people to offer special prayers on that day for immigrants and refugees. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, the Naval Academy Glee Club singing the Navy hymn, Eternal Father, Strong to Save, in a tribute video for the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.